I want to welcome the students who are with us today, and they are from Deerfield High School. Would they please stand? Thank you very much for coming today. You may be seated. The students are here with a program cleverly entitled Caught with Class. And this program is sponsored by the State Bar and this court. We invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If they come, they're given materials about the case they will hear. And at noon, they will meet with a justice of this court who has been assigned to meet with them. The discussion at noon or about noon will be the process the court uses to hear and decide cases, not the substantive issues involved. Everyone is welcome to that session. If anyone would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice with whom you will meet at noon. Seated next to Justice Bradley is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to Justice Prosser is Justice Annette Ziegler. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And there's an empty chair. Usually Justice Patrick Crooks sits there. Seated next to the empty chair is Justice Patience Rokensack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case, 08AP2766D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Lister. Mr. Lister, we've set up a microphone for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we're all set to go.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Ryan Lister, appearing pro se in this matter, Your Honor. I'd like to thank the court and Your Honors for this opportunity. It's an honor and a privilege. It is the last opportunity that any litigant has to ask the highest court in the state to make things right. Major concerns that bring me here to this day. The findings by the referee in this matter are clearly erroneous, and then I would like to address the issue of sanctions. It is a difficult burden to meet, and it is a rare case, but this is such a case. The clearly erroneous findings, I would like to start backwards and work with count four, I believe are easily shown in this matter. For example, it is clearly erroneous where a referee does not consider uncontroverted testimony. And what we have here in count four, dealing with the failure to cooperate with the district committee, there was uncontroverted testimony that there were telephone problems, that there was difficulty in receiving the messages, but more importantly, what the referee did not address in this matter, the uncontroverted testimony that a call was placed to attorney Chris Olson, the district chairman, and a question was posed to her as to, do you need any further information? And the response was no, and no further contact was made. That was not addressed. It is clearly erroneous where a fact finder does not address uncontroverted testimony that does not follow what the prosecution is asking for in this matter. That is only one particular issue, but I think it's a very egregious issue, and I believe it shows that those findings are erroneous. Another finding I believe that is erroneous, and I believe is a very egregious case in here, is there was some testimony that phone calls were placed to an 845 number, and that is a falsehood, and it was shown to be false. and to base findings based on a false evidence is clearly erroneous. The uncontradicted testimony is that as a result of a previous suspension, that phone number was terminated, as required by Supreme Court rules, and is followed up with by an affidavit. And interestingly enough, as reported by the OLR's investigator, the district committee's investigator, when she had attempted to call that number, it was terminated. It was turned off. The testimony presented as to the Haskins matter was that an attorney had attempted to call that number and had left a number of calls at that number. That is clearly not correct. And it could not have taken place, as the uncontroverted testimony showed that phone number had been disconnected and had never been turned back on. So the testimony by Attorney Cronenwinter that he had called that number on numerous occasions after that date is clearly false. And to base a decision on testimony that is clearly false is clearly erroneous. As we get to count one, again, the decision by the referee in this matter lists a number of facts found by the referee. However, in any case, the facts are to be based upon a willowing and a sifting of the facts, and you just cannot pick and choose facts that support a decision. You have to address all of the facts. For example, on count one, not addressed by the referee, Haskins wanted to do a civil rights case arising from the facts of the OWI case. And undisputed, uncontroverted testimony that Haskins was told that I do not do those. I haven't done one in a long time. I advised her of a number of attorneys and firms and had the ability and the finances to carry those lawsuits. It is uncontroverted that time went by. And that's a major fact relied upon by the referee, but he does not address that Haskins took vacations. They spent time in California. First she wanted to pursue the case, then she did not, then she did, then she did not, and to protect her remedy, I filed the case. Those are not addressed by the referee. A referee cannot pick and choose the facts that simply support the decision. They must be addressed. And then as far as, again, count one, talking about not turning the file over, the referee does not address facts such as Attorney Cronenwetter, who took over the case, was a brand new attorney. No one knew who he was. I was a little concerned about his address being his home, so I requested something in writing from him to obtain something so that I'm not giving the file to someone with no authorization. And those are facts. They're more laid out in detail in my brief, but those facts are not addressed by the referee. Then it...
Just so I'm clear on the facts, was the on-again, off-again wishes of Ms. Haskins in regard to the lawsuit something that occurred before the circuit court dismissed it with prejudice, or after, or both?
No, Your Honor, it was before. What had happened was the OWI case was resolved to Ms. Haskins' satisfaction. It's in the record, and I don't believe it's relevant here, but it was dismissed on a motion for no probable cause for the stop. But as a result of that stop, Ms. Haskins was subjected to some treatment that I believed was a civil rights violation.
That's the case that I was referring to, Counselor.
Yes, Judge. That, Your Honor, that was then over the years, she wanted to pursue it, and then she wouldn't. And she'd want to pursue it, and she wouldn't. And the six-year time limit under the federal statute was beginning to run. And I had told her during that period of time, I had done them in the past. I don't want to do them now. I don't have the financial ability to carry those types of cases. And I'd attempted to locate other attorneys who would. I've worked with other attorneys in the Madison area who do those types of cases. Is that the answer, Your Honor, or do you want me to continue?
Well, I guess, one of the problems is that suit was never served, correct?
I beg your pardon, ma'am?
The suit was never served.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Then, and I guess my concern is, and that was one of the things that was of concern to the referee. So if her on-again, off-again desires occurred before you filed the suit, once you filed the suit, I'm not quite sure how the on-again, off-again relate to never serving. That's what I was trying to put together.
Your Honor, it applies in this respect. Once the action was filed, and I admitted to the referee and I've admitted to this court that I did not serve, and there is no excuse for that, and I have not made any. And I've admitted to the referee, and I've taken responsibility for that. My conclusion is different than the referee's, though. And my conclusion is that is negligence, not an ethical violation. And the basis for that, Your Honor, is it wasn't addressed by the referee, but once that was brought to my attention by the new attorney, Jay Cronenwetter, I told him immediately what had happened. I offered to work with him on the file. I offered financial assistance to get it reopened, and I offered to do whatever it took to be reopened. And this, again, is not mentioned in the referee's findings, but it goes directly to this issue. Attorney Cronenwetter had clerked in federal court, was aware of the rules, and it was his opinion that it could be reopened on a basis of attorney negligence. And it is not addressed anywhere in the referee's findings of fact that the offer was made for full cooperation, financial assistance, whatever it took to reopen that matter. It is a negligence case. I have stood up, taken responsibility for that, and I say it today. I do not believe it is an ethical violation as the referee found.
Thank you.
So there, it's one is before the other, but...
Mm-hmm.
Then continuing on with...
Counsel?
Yes.
Could you address then the dismissal by the federal court of the lawsuit and the notice issue that attends that dismissal?
Yes, Your Honor. This was in front of Judge Shabazz, and as the record indicated, I have tried cases in front of Judge Shabazz. I was very familiar with his practice. Some refer to it as the rocket schedule that he has down there. And Judge Shabazz believes in moving things along promptly and with no delay. And I do not, as I've stated in the record, and to this day, did not receive those notices. Had I received them, I would have docketed them, I would have filed them. And as I've indicated, I'm familiar with his practice and how promptness is required in his court.
You also, with regard to this case, make assertions in the failure to cooperate, I think, charge that you didn't receive phone calls. Do I recall that correctly?
Judge, after the phone calls that I did not receive, Attorney Rotter testified to that, as did I, and it was uncontradicted testimony. After a previous suspension was imposed and that phone line was disconnected, I did not have the financial resources to hire a legal assistant. So I opted for a telephone company and an answering service. And Attorney Rotter testified, and I believe his credentials are very good, a former president of the Marathon County Bar Association, was a founding member and first president of the Marathon County Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. He's run for a judge in Marathon County. Attorney Rotter then had mentioned that he was in contact with me on virtually a daily basis. And in all candor to this tribunal, Attorney Rotter and I had some prior business dealings. Attorney Rotter and I had shared office space. We were never partners. We had shared office space and the costs of running an office in the past. And I just want that clear to the court that we had a prior business relationship. Attorney Rotter testified that he'd maintained a close business relationship, that he had attempted to contact my office on numerous occasions and was unable to get through. And he testified further that when he did leave messages and I received them, I returned them promptly. And that's the only answer I can give, Judge.
Thank you.
Well, we're talking about Attorney Rotter, and I think it dovetails in with any request for sanctions in this matter. Attorney Rotter, and interestingly enough, as the referee noted, Attorney Cronenwetter, are both familiar with my practices since the reinstatement. And Attorney Rotter has gone on, as did Attorney Cronenwetter, and they both talked about the, and it's uncontradicted testimony again, that the ethical standards, the discussions of ethical standards, the desire to zealously represent clients, and contributions far and above to the legal field. And I believe that's an extremely important since the previous suspension in 2007. One of the interesting things is Attorney Rotter has stated that there's a willingness to do work even if there's a negative impact personally. Some cases are unpopular. Some cases the community does not want to see fully defended. And I have defended those. Then Attorney Rotter says he believes this is the height of professional ethics. Attorney Rotter lays out the contributions to the practices that have been made. And I believe those were not considered in great detail by the referee in the discussion of the sanctions. And I'll come back to that in just a moment. Going as to, again, the phone calls, Don Lemke, the investigator from the local committee, has testified, again, uncontradicted, that the telephone number that was in existence on June 14, 2007 was disconnected per Supreme Court rule. Then there was testimony solicited by the OLR that Attorney Cronenwetter, and this is a delay in getting the file to him, testified that he called that number on numerous occasions. That is false testimony. It is a physical impossibility. That number had been terminated on June 14th or June 15th, 2007, and was never reinstated. And again, Don Lemke, the OLR's own investigator, testified that that number had been disconnected and never worked after that date. So the testimony and the reliance by the referee that Attorney Cronenwetter had called that number on numerous occasions and left messages is false. That argument was made clear at the hearing, it's clear in the evidence, and again, was not addressed by the referee. Briefly then, and as the last argument, I've laid it out in my brief a number of areas where I believe that the testimony is clearly erroneous. And I'm not going to go through them in any greater detail. I would like to address the issue of sanctions. And as I've indicated, and I take responsibility for it, there was negligence in the handling of that matter, without a doubt. It was not served, and I admit that, and I understand that. However, then we get to the sanctions that the referee has suggested to this court. And one of the sanctions goes back, or one of the facts relied upon by the referee is the past disciplinary record. He goes back to, I believe, about 1985 and is attempting to use things that are approximately 25 years old. To use an analogy in the criminal case situation, where you want to put in evidence of prior convictions, one of the factors courts look at is the age of the case. And it would be a rare, I believe, a rare situation where a court would let in, for impeachment purposes, a case that is 25 years old. And to go back and rely on something that is 25 years old is, I believe, again, an abuse of discretion in this matter.
When was the last time you were subjected to discipline,
counsel? 2007, Your Honor.
And what was the discipline then?
The gist of it was a number of things. There was one, failure to cooperate with the Office of Lawyer Regulation was one of those factors. And some of the other factors in that were lack of contact with clients.
Mm-hmm. And what was the discipline?
There was a suspension, Judge. I believe it was from June of 07 till November of 07 as a result of that, Your Honor.
I think it was about 5 months.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we have a concept of progressive discipline, as you know.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand that.
And in light of that, the proposal here is, what, 90 days, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you think 90 days is too much?
Yes, Your Honor. If I may explain, here's my thought process on that. This Haskins matter occurred just prior to the prior suspension. That 5-month suspension, which is no surprise and it's in the record, was an incredible financial burden, and it's in the record, which is difficult to respond from. But very detailed testimony in the record as to the practice since that time, as to the contributions, the high level of ethical practice, and so on. I believe the argument boils down to this. Since that suspension, since closing the office and all of the rules that are required with that, the practice since that date has been to the highest standards. As Attorney Rotter and the referee notes it also, as to Attorney Cronin-Winter had said. So the argument, I think, boils down to basically this. After that previous suspension, the practice has been higher than in the past, as the court obviously wishes. And therefore, I believe since this matter occurred right around that prior time, a suspension would be sufficient, Your Honor. I'm sorry, Judge. A public reprimand would be sufficient, Your Honor.
Are there any other questions? Do you want to say anything else, Mr.
Sir? The court's last question addressed, in essence, my closing argument. And if there are no further questions, then I would turn the floor over to the OLR.
Thank you, Mr. Lister.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel?
May it please the court, my name is Robert Crone, retained counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. It is again a privilege to appear before your honors in this disciplinary case. This involved 4 counts of discipline involving Mr. Lister, and the referee in a very detailed report found that all counts had been proven to the requisite standard. A number of credibility issues were raised in the case, and it resolved almost entirely, I think entirely, to the favor of OLR. The findings of the referee are not clearly erroneous under any evaluation.
Counselor, how do you address the argument that Attorney Lister makes today that the calls that were relied upon to this 815 number could simply never have been made because the number wasn't in existence? How do you address that as not being a clearly erroneous finding of fact?
Well, it is clearly erroneous because in turn there's two different areas of telephone calls. One was from Mr. Cronwitter dealing with the subject of taking over the case and getting the file.
I think that's the one he was referring to. He said he repeatedly called that number.
Okay, I think the other one was that he was referring to was when the district committee investigator was calling, and she got messages and testified as to all of the hearing Lister's voice on all of the messages. Now, on the other one, the Cronwitter matter, there was some ambiguity as to whether those calls went through or not, but the critical factor is that there is no ambiguity over the fact that Mr. Cronwitter sent a letter confirming a call, which is Exhibit 5 in the record, dated June 15th of 2007, confirming the calls and confirming the need to get the file. And then another call he said after that was made, and he testified that he talked to Lister on the second occasion.
I don't think that his argument was that he didn't talk to the attorney who was picking up the Haskin file. I think his argument was he wasn't negligent in contacting them, and I don't know, he just told us Don Lemke, and of course you are familiar with Don, as am I, testified that the phone number that he said he called repeatedly was not in existence at that time. That's what's kind of bothering me.
Okay, he said that. Dawn Lemke said that she got a response from him on a phone message saying he's out of the office, we'll be back at a such and such a date. This happened on six occasions.
I'm sorry, we're not on the same page, you and I. I am talking about a particular phone number that he's represented to us was discontinued at the time that it's alleged certain calls were made to that number. My concern is how repetitive were these calls, and if in fact some calls were made to a non-existent number, then obviously they weren't quite as repetitive as the report of the referee made.
The Lemke calls were made to an existing number with a return message on each one of them. The other calls made by Mr. Kronweather dealing with count three, he testified that he talked with Mr. Lister. And the referee, when he was confronted with this business about this phone number, rejected it, said there was no outside corroboration of problems with the phone, change in numbers, no documentation, nothing to support Mr. Lister's statement that this wasn't working. And the third count turned upon the fact that he didn't turn over the file and cooperate with the discontinuation of the representation.
I understand all of that. I'm just trying to get the phone call straight.
Okay.
Counsel, I'm not sure I have the facts correct, but this is a follow-up to Justice Rogensack's question. And I want you to tell me if I have the facts correct. That Kronweather testified that he made a call on June 15th requesting Haskins' file. Kronweather further testified that he also sent a letter making the same request for the turnover of the file. He further testified that he attempted several more phone calls to Lister, but either got a message that the mailbox was full or was unable to receive messages. That's what I understood Kronweather's testimony to be. I understood that the response to that was in part that he could not have made a call on June 15th because the phone number was disconnected. Yet this morning, I hear counsel Mr. Lister indicate that the number was disconnected on June 14th or 15th.
One of the findings of the referee.
So tell me what those.
I think you have it right in terms of the factual findings, the letters, the calls. And finding 25 of the referee, after June 15th, Kronweather made phone calls attempting to speak with Lister. The result being receipt of a recorded message that the mailbox was full or not able to receive messages. Kronweather has recall of a numerous attempts to reach Lister by phone that they were shut off by the phone system. And then there was a second phone discussion with Lister regarding the Haskins file. There was no clear indication of a date. So Kronweather had two discussions with Lister over the phone about this file, and then there were other attempts to reach him. Got a recorded message, then he got a message that the phone was out and so forth. So,
and he testified that the first call was on June 15th.
That was a call that they talked with one another, followed up by the letter saying, this is to confirm you're going to send the file. I want the file. And the file was not then sent. So regardless of these phone calls and what time the phone was connected or not connected, there was a clear understanding that Kronweather was going to be taking over the representation and a clear duty at that point to turn over the file, which wasn't done for months later. And that was the basis for that particular count.
So you're saying the referee accepted Kronweather's testimony about the phone calls and the letter?
Yes. This whole business about the phone wasn't working, I didn't get the mail and so forth, these are what I generically refer to as my dog ate my homework kind of arguments. That it wasn't corroborated by anything. There was not corroborated by any phone records. It wasn't corroborated by any people other than Mr. Lister's testimony. And as far as the federal lawsuit, nothing was done right in that case. And the fact that he says, I really wasn't she changed her mind, and I really didn't want to handle this case. And this is a negligence case. It is not. It is a count dealing with diligence and promptness, an ethical violation. He took on the case. He accepted the case. He pursued the case in the sense of filing it. He's the attorney of record. Didn't serve it. Then he didn't respond to the court's notices, knowing that the judge was a stickler on timetables. Months went by. Had given the court his address on the pleadings, had given a return envelope with his address. His address never changed. And his defense to that count is, well, I didn't get the court notice. The referee rejected that defense. There's a presumption of mailing under all the circumstances. And he says, I have no doubt it was mailed. I just didn't get it. But his address never changed. And this is a diligence and promptness situation. And then as far as count two, failure to inform his client, his defense is the same thing. I couldn't inform my client because I didn't know it was dismissed. Well, the referee rejected that. He filed the case at the 11th hour. He had the responsibility as attorney. He simply did nothing, sat back, and the case is dismissed. And he doesn't communicate with his client about the dismissal. She learns about it from Mr. Kronwetter, from a third party. And his defense that the mailings weren't received by him, whatever that defense was totally rejected by the referee and should be by this court. Those findings, based upon credibility, I do not believe should be upset by this body. Now, as far as the termination of the representation, we talked about that. There was a clear understanding that a 38-page file was to be turned over to Mr. Kronwetter in June. It wasn't sent out until August or September, depending upon which evidence the referee said. In either event, the delay was inappropriate, and he did not follow the rules under 21.16 sub D regarding his obligations upon termination of representation. He could have turned that file over and should have turned it over more quickly. He did not return any of the prepaid fees. There's only $135.60 involved here, but nothing was done about that. And his defense to not turning over the file is this business about not receiving the phone calls, but there's the letters in the record. And then he says, well, I was, coincidentally, I was suspended on that day, and I had ethical reasons. I didn't think I should turn over the file. Well, the referee rejected that. There is a grace period for a suspension. There is a duty upon suspension to see to a timely transfer of legal representation to other attorneys, and the referee rejected that defense. The last count deals with the investigator's efforts to meet Mr. Lister and talk with him about it. Mr. Lister knew there was an investigation by OLR. Mr. Lister had received correspondence, was aware that an investigator would be contacting him. She called on numerous occasions in June of 08, left messages, got his voicemail. He never responded. He just never responded, and this is a classic situation of non-cooperation. Now, he said he talked to somebody else at OLR, another grievance committee member, Olson. The fact is, his attempt to have the testimony of Olson introduced in evidence was objected to by me in the transcript, and the referee sustained that objection on the basis of hearsay. So there was no evidence considered by the court on that subject. That's at page 194 of the transcript. Now, in terms of sanction, I do believe this is a sanction case principally because of the fact the referee made these credibility findings that are not clearly erroneous. I believe that the 90-day suspension recommendation is very reasonable because we have a situation here where, yes, the public reprimand was years ago, but the most recent, most serious previous disciplinary violation was only 3 years ago, 4 years ago now.
This conduct of Mr. Lister preceded that discipline, didn't it?
I don't know that really makes a difference, assuming that to be true, and I don't have the facts as to the specifics of the conduct leading to the 2007 violation. So I don't know whether that is correct, but even if it is correct, we have a...
At least it's at the same time period.
It's generally right. The same time period, the same right. Conduct. Okay. It's fairly fresh. Right. And we did not seek, as Your Honor had mentioned, an escalated sanction because the fact that we thought the 90-day suspension was sufficient given these facts, and the prior 5-month suspension was based upon, I think, a very serious, a number of accounts. I think there were at least a dozen or so accounts and more than one client, and far more serious. So we didn't feel that it really worked in the steps of progressive discipline. But we do feel that it warrants more than a, significantly more than a public reprimand, and we felt a 90-day suspension with restitution of the remaining amount plus interest is appropriate. Mr. Lister has his prior disciplinary history. Not only that, the violations that he that it resulted in past discipline are very similar to what we have here. Neglect of clients, non-communication, non-cooperation, just sitting back and doing nothing when he has a responsibility to represent people. And then listing here excuses as to why he didn't do something. I didn't get the mail, or the phones weren't working, or whatever. These were not legitimately proven defenses in this case and were rejected by the referee. And I think they're indicative of Mr. Lister's efforts to just kind of shed responsibility for this behavior and blame others or blame the system or blame his phones or AT&T or whoever might be out there to blame. This was not corroborated. The other cases we cited in our brief, which we think are instructive, are the Converse case, which was a 90-day suspension for similar neglect, competency, non-cooperation kind of issues, and the Rios case, which was a 60-day suspension, although in Rios there was no prior discipline, and that also involved a constellation of neglect, competency, non-cooperation sorts of things. So in closing, unless there are other questions, OLR stands by its recommendation, which we think is well supported in this record, and that the referee's decision is a well-crafted, detailed decision that is that supports a 90-day suspension.
Thank you, Mr. Crone. Mr. Lister, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, again today, the argument
of this case is very disingenuous. Just a minute. Yeah. The marshal's going to get the mic for you. That's all right.
The argument I'm making today and the argument by the OLR is very disingenuous, almost to the point of anger. We hear the testimony today by the OLR, the argument that there was no outside corroboration that that phone was disconnected. That representation to this court is absolutely false. Dawn Lemke, their own investigator, testifies in the record in the document at page 191 that that number had been disconnected.
Counsel, that touches upon for me the question. You earlier said that she testified that it was disconnected on June 14th or June 15th. You also said it was an impossibility, and in fact, Attorney Cronenwetter's testimony was false that he called you on June 15th because the phone was disconnected. Can you square that for me? Because it sounds to me like he could have easily called you on the 15th because you don't know for sure when it was disconnected, the 14th or 15th.
Judge, I believe, and again, the testimony here goes to, I don't know. It had to be disconnected by June 15th per Supreme Court order. And my testimony was to the effect that it was to be turned off June 14th. And after June 15th, or on June 15th, I had no business in the office whatsoever.
But can you validly claim that his testimony that he called you on June 15th is false, as you said, because your phone was turned off on June 15th? It doesn't sound to me like you can validly claim that.
Yes, Judge, I believe it is false testimony, and more particularly, Attorney Cronenwetter doesn't just limit it to that date. He said there were several other calls after that date he made to that phone number.
Yes, I know that.
That is absolutely cannot be true. And the argument that there's no outside corroboration, their own investigator and Attorney Rotter, who is unimpeached, discusses that also.
Help me with this, if you would. So the argument by your opposing counsel was, hey, this sounds like the dog ate the homework. And when I look at the prior case for which you were suspended, there was a lot of dog ate the homework stuff going on there, too. For example, if I recall correctly, you on failure to communicate, you said you misaddressed a response to the OLR. You had indicated that you could not have called the OLR on a particular day, as the OLR asserted, because you were hospitalized, it was determined that you weren't hospitalized on that day, that you claimed that you had sent a summons and complaint to a processor server, but the service was never obtained, and then part of the discipline was for telling the clients you had to file a new lawsuit because the defendants were switching counsel. A lot of that sounds like my dog ate homework. So tell me why I shouldn't keep that in mind as your opposing counsel is arguing with regard to this. Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe that's gone tomorrow.
Your Honor, there's an answer to that. And number one, and I think it goes in this order, the dog ate it or shed responsibility argument. Mm-hmm. The OLR totally glosses over and misrepresents. It is undisputed that after not hearing anything from the local community, my testimony was clear that I had called the local chairman, Attorney Chris Olson. The objection was to the contents of that call as to what Attorney Olson said on the grounds of hearsay and Crawford and so on. But it's undisputed that I followed up to talk to them. And it's undisputed that Attorney Rotter had testified to problems I had when I was resetting my office and getting things going. That's undisputed. And then to make the argument that the dog ate it and that there was a total shedding of responsibility, again, is disingenuous. The testimony from Cronenwinter is that I told him that the mistakes were done. I told him I would do whatever I could to help him, and I told him I would assist in any manner, and I would assist financially to get that taken credit. Then also to go on and to say they shed responsibility, that was exactly the same response made to the OLR's allegations, exactly the same response made to the referee. And as I said to this court today, I'm not sitting here saying that I didn't do those things. I said I did do them, and I did say they were negligent. My argument is it doesn't rise to the ethical level. I'm not saying the dog ate it by any means. I stood up and took responsibility for it, Judge. Does that answer the court's question?
That's a response, yes. Thank you.
And in essence, Your Honors, to finish up on it, this argument about outside corroboration, and there's a lot of confusion here, and I want to clear it up. There were two distinct phone periods. There was the time when I had to turn off my previous phone, and that's the one Don Lemke has testified to that was disconnected. Then when I was reinstated was a new phone system and a new answering system that had to, again, uncontroverted, that had to be changed out because it wasn't functioning. There is absolutely no dispute about that. And Attorney Rotter testified to that situation also. Those are two separate numbers. And the first number that was terminated is the one that Cronenwetter claims that he had called on a number, I've forgotten the number, but a number of occasions. The second new number was the number when my office was reopened, and that's the number where the argument is Don Lemke could not or left messages that were not returned. That's where Attorney Rotter addresses that issue, and it's at that time period, and I have admitted in the reports that I had received everything from the OLR. It's undisputed that I called Attorney Olson, the district chairman, and my testimony was to the effect of, do you have everything you need? And not a single request was made of me after that. And I want to finally close with the argument, and I think it's very important here. Not one thing was withheld from the OLR. Not one thing. And that is not the allegation here. But I want to make it clear that not one piece of information was withheld from the OLR. The claim is made that I didn't respond promptly during a period of suspension for an attorney I did not know undisputed. I asked for ethical opinions from the state bar itself as to how to handle that matter, whether going into my office was considered practice, etc. And that's undisputed. Finally, again, addressing the issue of sanction, as the Chief Justice pointed out previously, there is a system of progressive discipline. It is my position that the last discipline, and again, undisputed, the changes that have been made to my practice since 2007 and contributions that I have made to the practice of law weigh in favor of a public reprimand in this matter. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Lister, for your arguments and your brief today in what is always a difficult matter for the respondent and for OLR and for the court. So we appreciate your contributions. And thank you, Mr. Crone, representing the OLR. That completes our argument in 08 AP 2766D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Ryan Lister. We'll take a few moments in recess so that these students, if they wish, may leave and additional students may come into the court.